So we were still on the introduction, but we're going to finish it up tonight. The introduction to Ecclesiastes. We left off on page 4, and we were just going through some of these, discussing the focus of the book, and the narrow view that the preacher has taken in of life, and discussed some of the passages and the differentiation between how things are read in Ecclesiastes and how the other scriptures read. We saw the message in Ecclesiastes is life on earth is all that's being studied, or that's what the focus is on, and to enjoy life is the best thing, versus all the other scriptures we see in the rest of the Word of God, or there's life after death in heaven, and that we're allowed to enjoy what we have on earth, but that shouldn't be our focus. Our focus is service, obedience to God. That's always our focus, not the things of this earth. So that's what Ecclesiastes is about. The focus is on life on earth. However, it doesn't mean that the preacher, the author, is without a belief in God or in a belief of the a future beyond this life. We know that God is mentioned in this book, and we see the preacher's faith in the beginning of Ecclesiastes 2, in verse 24 and 26, we first see mention of God. He says, "Nothing is better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God." In verse 26, "For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering, collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God." And also in verse 10 in chapter 3, I'm not going to read all of 10 through 17, but it discusses God a lot. See, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. In verse 14, "I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him." See, and in verse 17, "God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there's a time there for every purpose and for every work." And so see here, it has mentions gifts from God, wisdom and the ability to enjoy life. He also mentions God's judgment. And so, there could be, he could be discussing here judgment of men on earth, and, in the Old Testament, he judged men according to their deeds, and they saw his judgment before the next life. Nations were judged, men were judged, doing wrong, they usually expected some recompense in this lifetime. And that's how they developed the idea that those who were wealthy were doing what was right, and those who weren't must have done something wrong to deserve it. Of course, we know God doesn't always work that way. And we're going to get more into that in the next lesson. And even he mentions here in other verses that sometimes the righteous suffer, and sometimes the wicked receive goodness, and their days are prolonged. that's getting off topic, but we'll get there. I think I also wanted to read in chapter 5, verse 1-7. Says, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God. Draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven, and you on earth. Therefore let your words be few." And verse 4, "When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay." And so through here, we see his belief in God. We see God's nature. He's ruling over us, that there is a judgment, that he does recompense people for their vows, for their wickedness. And so there is more, as we know, and he knew as well, there is more beyond just this life. But when he's discussing all these things, he's bringing in the focus and not, you know, not, I want to say ignoring it, but not regarding it for the moment, to just to focus everything on this life, what is under the sun. And then also, like I said, he mentions the righteous, the judgment, so there is a future. In chapter 7, verse 18, I think that was a weird one. I want to read that one. I must have put it in there for a reason when I saw it, and I go, yeah, that makes sense. And then later when I was studying, I go, what was I thinking? I was like, I don't even understand it now. Chapter 8, 12 through 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are the shadow, because he does not fear before God. And so, again, we see a judgment, God's judgment on the actions of men. verse 11:9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. And the very end of the book, 12:7, verse 7 of chapter 12, says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And so here's definite proof of the belief of life after death. The spirit does not perish. It, you know, it does not cease to exist. That man, when he dies, that's not the end of it here on earth. The spirit goes on back to God. And so we will see other verses, I think, in chapter 2 and 3, that it talks about, you know, what good does a man have? He dies and it's over. You know, in chapter 3, it compares a man to the beast. You know, man and the beast alike perish and return to dust. And so there he's taking that view of just, you know, without aspect anything else, life under the sun ends. And we know it ends. And he's not regarding that which comes after for the purpose of, of, you know, trying to find the questions to the answer he's posing in verse 3, in the very beginning of the book. What profit does man have under the sun? That's what he's trying to focus on. So, there is life after death. There is a God. He is ruling. He's watching over everything. But that's not the complete focus of the book. It's acknowledged, but it's not the focus. And because of that, I think at the beginning I said he had that, the purpose of the whole book is to answer that question. What profit does man have under the sun? And I mentioned before, I believe, that he answers that. And sort of answers it twice, sort of. I like to say that. You know, we know in chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, he says, you know, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? In verse 3. And verse 2 is where he answers it. Everything is vanity. And so, as he goes through this book, he's discussing everything, and he shows that that's the case. Every man has no profit under the sun. That's the narrow focus. But then, at the very end, in chapter 12, when he gives his conclusion, that's where he changes the focus momentarily and says, you know, based on that conclusion, we've come to the conclusion that everything on life is futile, is fleeting. You know, what, do we just give up in despair? No. Now we bring in God, we bring in life after this earth, and that, based on the fact that we have nothing to profit us with just life on earth, we have his conclusion in 12:9 that we are to seek God and obey his commandments. I'm going to go ahead and read it. In chapter 12 and 13 it says, fear God and keep his commandments. For this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so I like to consider that the real answer to what we our meaning and our purpose in life. And that really is where we gain our true profit. So of course, it's not the profit under the sun, because we don't receive the profit of obeying God until after we've left this earth. So does anyone have anything to add to that?
I think 12:1 is a tying, you know, phrase when you consider all that he's talking about. The young man, remembers God in his youth while he's enjoying the things that God's given him, and he's enjoying the fruit of his labors. Because there's going to come a time when dark times come upon you, or you get older, and you may not have delight in these things anymore. And you're going to have to remember God in those times, so you don't fall away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, God's going to judge us for our actions in those times. Mm-hmm. So, we know God is forgiving, but he still remembers some things. We don't want to forget God. And yeah, you're right. If we fall away when you're young, when things are good, if you haven't developed that faith then, when things get rough, will you turn back or not?
In verse 1,
yes.
You're talking about youth, but in verse 2, and especially in the same, it says, be not darkened nor the clouds return after rain. Would that be more of representing the old ages coming?
I believe so. Okay. How about? He goes into several things here, and I think that's the sun and the light, the moon and stars are darkened. It's most people losing their vision, and
right.
We'll go into that later.
All right. Well,
you're correct. I mean, we go into that, and the next verse says, "When the keepers of the house tremble mm-hmm. and the strong men bow down," they're all, I believe, talking about the characteristics of old age, things we all are going to face. if you're lucky enough to get to old age.
Well,
I'd like to get there.
Yeah. Well, just have to wait till verse 12. I mean, chapter 12 and say verse 3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's fine. I mean, we're always going to be looking to other parts of the book, moving ahead to say, look at this verse, verses under the same context to help us determine the meaning of some verse. So it's fine moving around, but yeah, we will get there.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Like, see, in verse 2 is talking about old age is coming, in verse 3, each one of those is a different body part that's breaking down.
Michael's interesting you're pointing out that in Solomon's recognition of what he needs to do and how he should live, he's pointing towards God's omnipotence, his omniscience, and we're going to answer to him because he's all knowing all the time, and he's going to bring some judgment and interfere. That's what the point is here in chapter 12, the freedom of obeying his commands, because he knows it all. And we're going to answer to him and just say, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah. And we're going to see God's wisdom and sovereignty long before we get to chapter 12. Like, he brings God into view in several different instances, and but the focus is on life on earth to help clarify that. And so the outline of this book, the first three verses are sort of the introduction, the preface to what's going to be talked about, what's defined throughout the whole book, gives us our theme and the purpose of the whole book. And then verses, chapter 1, verse 4, all the way through the end of chapter 6, are going to be observations of life that the preacher has made. And it's going to be all the data he's gathered and, laid out and analyzed to show the answer he's come up with to that question. And except for a few little parts. And then chapter 7 through most of chapter 12 is going to be the wisdom we can apply in our lives. So based on what we know of life, based on what he's seen in his analysis, here's what we can do, how to live our lives as best we can. And of course, the very last, chapter 12, 9 through verses 9 through 14 is the exhortation, the conclusion of it all, where that's where he steps back. We've analyzed life under the sun. Here's that conclusion. Based on that, everything's vanity. You can live your life using these, we're using wisdom to live out a good life, but it's all profitless. Steps back. Let's look of more of God and life after. And there we see the final remarks and what the true meaning of our life is. The purpose of our life should be. Yes, Rocky?
On your second part of that, like observations of life.
Yes.
I had it titled a little bit different. It definitely shows observations of life, but it kind of drives home the point But I titled it The Vanity of All Earthly Endeavor. And of course, he's going to be looking at observations, but I mean, he's going to be driving home this point about vanity and life endeavors.
Yes. We know we're going to see vanity a lot. It's the theme of the book, and it's throughout the book. It's by no means, this outline is not the answer. It's just how I fashioned in my mind. And like I said, the observations of life, it takes a few breaks from that and moves to a few different topics within that chapter 1 through 6. But it's still a little piece out of the whole. And I just make it nice and neat, stuff it up my head. That's the way I roll. Any other comments? Any other thoughts on the matter? We can move on to chapter 1. So in chapter 1, you know, beginning in verse 1, he identifies the author, the writer identifies himself, and it was the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. He doesn't identify himself by name, but we established who that was. Who did we say the author was?
Solomon.
Yeah, Solomon. And in verse...
Oh, I did some research.
Yes.
And one of the main people that thought it was not Solomon was Martin Luther.
Did he have reason to... I mean, to dispute it, or is it some of the same reasons we've already discussed?
Some of the same reasons we've already discussed, yeah. But I looked into it.
I mean, I guess, does it lead to any purpose, or...
No, just
okay, I think it's somebody else, and yeah. Everything still remains the same. All right. So in verse 3, like I've already mentioned, we see the purpose of this whole book. You know, what the driving force was. What profit has man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And in verse 2, we see the answer to that. The vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And we've defined vanity as that which is fleeting, which is futile, profitless, that which is empty. And or if it has any profit, like I said, it falls in with that fleeting. If it's anything to gain, it's too fleeting to maintain, to measure. And vanity of vanities, I was going to go into more detail here. We actually discussed it a little bit last time. It's a well-known Hebrew idiom. It's as we call in our language, a superlative, where we use our superlatives are, that is the greatest, or that's the most awesome. That's probably wrong in grammar, but the most is usually what you see. And the most defines something as that above that is around it. That is, who's the tallest? Maybe Jim Porterfield's the tallest in here. Well, he now, I don't know if he is, but... Oh, David, are you taller?
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, maybe you're pretty tall. So you'd be the tallest. So out of the group, you've been set aside, and you're the highest degree of tall. And so here we see vanity of vanities, the Hebrew name to... discussing vanity to the highest degree, and it's also seen in Hebrews 9:3 when discussing our God. Of course, Hebrews is written to Hebrews, so it's going to use some of the same terminology. Then 9 verse 3, it says, "And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the..." My verse says, "The holiest of all." But I was studying with another translation, and it says the holy of holies. You know, defining that which is behind the veil of the tabernacle as the holiest of all degrees. And I think, Rocky, you mentioned in last class something about foolish, or was that another scripture from the Bible, or is that just an example of...
I don't remember what I
said. Well, we were talking about the Holy of Holies, yeah. Or the Vanity of Vanities. I thought you said something about the
I just said it was a footnote in American Standard. It says the futility of futilities.
Oh, okay, yeah, futility.
Futility
of futilities. Okay. Yeah, that's, I guess that's the same thing. You're defining vanity as futility, so they just reused it that way. Well, I suppose if you read more Hebrew, you'd probably see it a lot more. But I don't. And so we go into the beginning of the observations of life in verse 4. Yes, David?
I was doing some studying last night on that word all is vanity, and I'm struggling with it. Is that universal or not universal, the word all there? Because in the book Solomon, he talks about fear of God, enjoyment, and proper use of wisdom is profitable. But when you talk about vanities, it's you use the word futile, useless, or no value of profit. So I'm struggling with that a little bit. Is he saying, for the most part, all is vanity, like universal, or no matter what, it's all vanity? Because in the book, he goes into a little bit, and he says that these, like three things I mentioned, he said these do have some profit.
Yeah. I think we have to read the verses you're talking about. I've read through everything. I think it is the universal of everything under the sun. Okay. Now, when you say you saw where it said wisdom is profitable, I think I know what you're talking about in chapter 2, where it says wisdom is better than folly. So it's not that it gives us profit, but it is better. Okay. You know, I don't know how to scare that. Did you have a comment right here?
I just want to make a comment. I think your answer is just right on there, Michael. And I just want to make the point that in the Bible, always sometimes when we see the word all or never, we always make those words absolute. So many times in the Bible, when we see those words, in most cases, they're not absolute. Context defines it. And so here, all the vanity, was God vanity? Their soul vanity? The common sense doesn't tell us. But like you said, it's all under the sun.
Yeah.
I guess one of the best examples of this principle here is in Genesis, chapter the flood. You have this word all flesh being used in Genesis. And it actually talks about, in one case, all flesh referring to wicked people, but it did include Noah. One case, it's the animal life. And so usually you have to use context to determine it. So here,
I think it's... I think I know what in Genesis where it says all flesh was destroyed. All flesh that wasn't on the ark was destroyed. And here we're talking about, I think it is, and under the context where it says all his vanities, and then he mentions it's all under the sun, like I said, that everything in this in here is about the context of under the sun. Now God is mentioned, and we know it's profitable to fear God, but if you're looking at only under the sun, fearing God may not bring you any profit. Even if God blessed you with riches, is that profitable? You're going to die and it's gone. If he prolongs your life, he's only prolonged it. And then you're dead and it doesn't matter anyway. Or, you're still going to die. So your end result is the same. You haven't gained any profit. And in anything, you see, as we read through here, all your days are full of labor, which is sorrow. But prolonging your days, you're going to die anyway, but now you just have a lot more work to do. Well, is that profitable? You work, and everything you work for is gone and lost. Well, that wasn't profitable. So, it's a matter of everything on here is not profitable. We may, like I said, I think it's a clear case of where we start to get confused again by associating that life after death and fearing God, what that brings. We're losing that narrow focus we were talking about.
That's why I'm looking at it underneath a microscope.
Yeah, we're just looking at it underneath a microscope, and we got to maintain that view to understand what he's saying. But we know, like I said, that there's more outside of this, but in order to understand these scriptures and interpret the context. And like, if I'm not certain which verse you're talking about, the wisdom, but I know in chapter 2, verse 13, it says, "And then I saw that wisdom excels folly." But as he goes on to show later in that verse, wisdom is better than folly. It's better to be wise. But it may gain you stuff here on earth, but all of it is too fleeting to be counted as profit.
I was thinking about the wisdom. We know that, like we discussed, wisdom here on earth, quote wisdom, is in the end, it's worthless. No matter if you how wise you are, but when you contrast that with God's wisdom, the great wisdom God gave to him, and then I think he got came to conclusions he came to in God, in his what he learned through the Lord. Well, and I think there's a difference there. That's not vanity, and that's not fleeting, because you know that's going to get you somewhere. And I don't know if there's a comparison there, or but I mean, that's what something I was thinking about.
I mean, really, the only prophet we're ever going to have that really counts for something is life in heaven. Anything that we know of on this earth is going to be lost. But the only difference is that which we do here gets us that profit. But like I said, life in heaven doesn't count as under the sun. Therefore, we don't have anything profitable here.
The point is, nothing here is going to get you to heaven. There's no wisdom here that will get you there. That's God. That's God.
Correct. Obedience to God.
2:16 says, the wise man and full man are alike.
Yes.
Now, that's the point. It's like wisdom can be great. It's,
Yeah. Wisdom gets you a little bit while you're here, but it's still going to lose it all. And so we're beginning to look at the observations of life of vanity illustrated, and beginning in verse 4 in chapter 1. And so beginning in verse 4, how does the author demonstrate the vanity under the sun, futility under the sun? How does he illustrate that in verse 4?
People live and people die.
Yeah, people live and people die.
He even used the words hasten, quickly. Like, it's not, I think he puts a little timetable, like you said, people live and die, but it's kind of like when you get older, it seems time goes faster. That's happening to me already.
Sorry about that. Where are you getting
you
there?
Don't
where
saying
that?
Where
are you quickly?
Wait, are we on?
We're in verse 4.
Oh, sorry. I'm thinking about verse 4. Sorry about this. Sorry.
Yeah, verse 4, one generation passes away, and another generation comes. So yeah, people are born, and people are die, and then those people are replaced by new people that are born. And it happens over and over and over again, without end. This is a never-ending cycle, the generations of people on earth. And but the earth abides forever. So is that forever? Does that mean the earth's going to be eternal?
No.
No.
Yeah, it's a matter of it's not a matter of eternity, but the idea of forever, when we're talking about like under the sun, our lives are short. It's a long duration of time. It's, you know, we don't know the duration. We know the earth is finite, but it's a lot longer in our lives. It's been here, we know, in recorded history for, I don't know, it's recorded history goes back 3,000 years. That's long enough to be forever in my book. Of course, it's not really eternally forever.
Michael, here's another example about absolutes. You know, you just made the point. I mean, we're just talking about all in verse 1, but really forever.
Yeah.
And then we know it's not forever. So it's, again, another really example of how absolutes don't always mean absolutes.
That's correct. Right. In verse 5, how is futility illustrated?
Days come, days go.
The sun repeats its cycle every single day, right? Every 24 hours, it does the same thing.
You seem like the laws of God set in motion. We're not going to change those. There's a set need for a given time, but those laws aren't going to change because God made them. And as far as the laws of nature, what He did for us.
Yeah.
No matter what we do, the sun's going to come up. The sun's going to set. The sun's going to come up.
That's right. And in verse 6.
Or it's circular.
Yeah. It's the wind patterns. The wind doesn't just blow to the south. We may be in one location. We feel like it always blows south here, and it's fine. But, you know, due to the nature of matter, then if it only went that way, we'd have a buildup of oxygen wherever at the end point. You know, the wind flows to the south and then changes direction, goes back north again, with the heating and the thermal cycles of the earth. in verse 7,
they're just keep running into the sea.
Yep. We keep running the sea. It's a matter of the, I don't know the scientific name for it, like the evaporation cycle. That, yeah, you know, the snow melts, forms a river, flows into the sea, and we know that water evaporates, goes into the clouds and gets rained or snowed on the land, just to repeat the cycle over again. It flows back downhill to the sea.
And the water just doesn't stop. It's always flowing. It's always constant.
That's correct. Yeah, we see the wind's always moving, the water's always flowing, the sun is always moving, and generations of man are always living and dying. None of these things, all these things are laboring to complete their tasks. And are their tasks ever complete? No, we just keep going round and round. In verses 8 through beginning of verse 9, what illustrates the vanity there? It's not as easy as
it
was. Our desire.
Keep desiring.
I wouldn't use it as the desire.
What's the answer? What's the question?
In verse 8 through 9, what illustrates the futility? How is it illustrated here?
Men are never satisfied. Right. Whatever happens, nothing's going to be enough. We'll just...
Yeah, I actually didn't take it as man's desires being satisfied or not. Here, I take it as labor is never, work is never complete. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. We can't utter the fact of how all things are full of labor. And as an example, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. It's not a matter of desiring to hear, but as long as our eyes and ears are working, they don't stop working. Or, you know, they continue to, you continue to hear, you continue to see, you continue to labor doing and using what you have. There is no point where, yep, I've satisfied, I'm profited enough, I'll just close my eyes and lay down, you know, not listen or do anything. It's a matter of, those are the functions we have. So long as they work, they don't stop. And in the beginning of verse 9, I think it shows that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. It's this idea of labor. We continue to labor, and when we complete something, it's gonna get done again, either by us or by generations to come after.
You know, doesn't change anything.
The food we grow every spring, we plant every harvest, every fall we reap and we consume it, and we're gonna do it again next year too. And all of these things are to sustain life. And if you read science and things like that, of course, we all know the sun has to circle, it has to go down, it has to come up. You don't want it up all the time because it will scorch things and it won't be suitable for life. The flowing of the wind and the ocean, that has to continue to happen. If something were to stop, that cycle would have stopped, it would lead to the end of life. I saw, I think it was in Europe one time, they were talking about stagnant water develops hydrosulfide, which is lethal. And there's some pond in New York that there's the springs that fed it stopped. And so it has no new flow. And so that water that's there stays there. And 3 feet under the water, it's toxic. No one can swim in it and nothing lives at all. And so the current, the ocean, they're referencing this all to the ocean currents. How the ocean currents flow from the north, the cold water, you know, the cold makes it sink. It flows to the equator, warms up, rises to the surface and goes back north again. And they have all these ocean cycles. If those ocean cycles were to cease, the ocean would turn to toxic and everything in it would die. And of course, we know that's not going to happen so long as God sustains life on Earth. But we see these never-ending cycles, and we say, okay, well, yeah, it sustains life, the labor to sustain life. Is that profitable? I kind of want to stay alive. I view it as some profit, but what's the end result?
Doesn't change anything. Doesn't change anything. We can do.
Yeah, these things don't change. But is to labor to live a profitable endeavor?
While you're
under the sun. I mean, really, we're doomed to fail, aren't we? We're going to strive and work real hard to stay alive, only to die anyway. We're not. We're not gonna maintain the goal of life. Yeah, if we're going to sustain our life, and if we continue to work, we can prolong our lives for a while. But all we do is incur more work while we do it. And eventually, whether we want to or not, we're gonna cease to live here on Earth. We're going to move on to 9 and 11. 9 through 11, the last part of 9 through 11. What do we see here?
Let me ask you a question. In your notes you have in verses 8, I didn't check the King James and New King James. Does the New King James say all things are full of labor?
Yes.
That's what mine says. I have New King James. All things
are full of labor. That emphasizes the point about the work.
Yeah.
It helps. Because you know, New American stands all things are worrisome.
Yeah.
But I think King James helped you understand what it's looking at, the labors of man.
Yeah, I have a footnote that says, yeah, all things are wearisome. And I think there's another version that says all things are full of weariness. I believe that's what it says. All things are full of weariness. So it's not a matter of... I think it's a matter of, you know, the suffering, the case of weariness. Labor makes you weary, and as long as we're always laboring, we're going to be suffering from that weariness. So I think it brings about the same idea. Maybe it's a little more difficult to get there, but we know laboring. We all know laboring makes you tired. So, any other comments? So 9 through 11, what do we see illustrates vanity here?
This is no. It's all the same. Is that new?
There's nothing new. It's
change.
It's
I'm sorry. No. There's nothing that we're going to do that's going to change us. We've got things like said before. It's God's putting the motion. We're not going to change it. There's nothing we do here on the earth will ever change that.
Yeah. Did David get a comment?
I was looking at verse 10. I mean, God set up the world already. He's established certain laws. Like you said, you already went into like the tidal waves and the earth's tilt. And there's stuff we don't even know about the world that we haven't discovered yet that God already knows about. Like, say, just recently, in this last century, you know, we've discovered the atom. God already knew about the atom. Or about different species that have been discovered. He already knew about those, too. He knows about everything. All we're doing is just, I don't know if it'll call it, but whenever humans go and think they've discovered something new, they really haven't. Because it's already existed.
Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. I have some more thoughts on that. I don't think this is talking about new knowledge. I think there is new knowledge. I mean, yeah, God knows everything, but to man, discovering the atom was something new. But I don't think that's what he's talking about here. I have down in point 3. We'll get there. We want to wait a minute. And we'll get into that more in depth. But, 9 through 11... I took that as the experiences of man are a never-ending cycle. You know, we're going to, what we do has already been done, and you know, it's been in times ancient, in ancient times. The fact that there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come, are talking about, you know, not so necessarily new knowledge and knowledge that happens again, but, you know, man's individual experiences. Our individual experiences are forgotten, and someone else is going to come along and experience and do new things, and everything he does is forgotten. So all human experience is going to be, it's going to occur and it's going to be forgotten, and they're going to do it again. Rocky, did you have a comment?
Just emphasize the point. He always keeps coming back to verse 3. You know, there are no new things in connection with what's going to profit a man. It's going to change his outcome from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Now, if you change that focus, if I look at, well, you know, the electron or atom or you know, there's certain things that benefit man in a, you know, maybe part of his life, but I mean, it doesn't change the profit of the man from beginning to end. He's still going to die.
Yes.
So we're going to kind of keep coming back to verse 3.
Yeah. Keep hitting on that. Getting that under our grasp. Sorry.
Doesn't chapter 2, verse 16 also say both the wise men and the foolish men die?
Yes.
So,
yeah. So, in all these things we've just read, we see there are never-ending cycles of the wind, the sun, the water of our works. And so we see what was accomplished. Nothing was accomplished. Everything is a circle. It goes right back to where it was. The sun starts here and ends where it began and does it again. Just like we our activities in life are repetitive, and we work to get ahead, and every fall we're doing the same thing over again. in lots of different ways, and not just associated with harvesting. But there's nothing ever is accomplished. Everything ends where it began and continues on in its labor. So, in verse 8 through 9, we're going to go more discussion about that and labor. And we already jumped into some of this. New King James, I have the New King James. In verse 8, all things are full of labor. The American Standard says full of weariness. What does my footnote say? Oh, my footnote says wearisome. All things are wearisome. So how do we define labor? In the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, labor is defined as the expenditure of physical or mental effort. And so most of us work or have worked. We know that's labor. We're paid for our labor. Is that the strictest view of labor, or is labor here in these contexts more expansive than that? So do you only work at labor if you have an 8-hour a day job? You only labor 8 hours a day, and then the rest of your day is you don't have any more labor?
You always have worries. Or you're always thinking about what you can do next. Yeah. I think when you're I love that word wearisome in there, because you come home, you're tired, but then you get more tired because now you're done with your job at work. Now you got a job to be a husband, or a job to be something else.
You always have other responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Just to family, to as a husband, or to your partners, to your children. I believe, based on this broad term of expenditure of physical and mental effort, I think it applies more to just what we consider as work. Like, we consider work the things we don't necessarily want to do, that we, mowing the lawn or bathing the kids. But, it talks about physical or mental effort. We always use mental effort and physical effort, even in those things which we find enjoyable. You go have a fun day we're going to enjoy an amusement park. You go to the amusement park for a day. You have a plan, and this is going to be all fun. No work, no labor. And at the end of the day, what do you feel like? You've been all day at the amusement park. I usually feel pretty tired. And you're like, why am I so tired? I had fun. That was, it's not, it's good work, but it's still work. It's expending energy. It's physical effort, walking around, doing fun things. Get some of the guys together, we play tennis every 2 weeks. That's my fun. I'm still really tired after I stop. I'm weary. This labor here isn't talking about just man has to work to provide for himself. Or I believe it, it isn't just that man has to work to provide for himself, that all things under the sun are labor. No matter what you do, even if it's enjoyable, even if it's something you want to do, it's still a form of activity. It can be applied to work. It's an activity. An activity is, every day when I use the term work, I hold that term to my 8 hours at the office. Or maybe when I have to do some yard work. And after that, it's not work. But it's still, I'm laboring in my life under the sun. I'm doing things. Even if you sit down and watch TV, the epitome of not doing much, you're still doing something, and it doesn't have any profit for you. So, do you have a comment?
No.
Sorry. So, in the last part of the verse, we spoke of the eye and the ear, not satisfied with or filled. I guess we'll.